Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We'll hear highlights from the 2014 Chamber of Commerce Economic Outlook Luncheon, including the keynote address presented this year by special guest speaker Bruce Katz, Vice President, Brookings Institution, and founding director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. The title of his talk will be Insights on the Metropolitan Revolution. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, December 9, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Steve Saleen, Chairman of the Board at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. Chamber of Commerce Chief Executive Officer David Brown will then present the Economic Outlook Survey highlights and introduce the keynote speaker.
I'm Steve Saleen. I'm Chairman of the Board of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce this year, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this year's Economic Outlook Luncheon. Today we set our sights on the future of our region and your business, the next economy, and the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead. As we look forward, we're backed by our powerful momentum. Our economic progress since 2004 has resulted in more than 530 projects, representing nearly 28,000 jobs and close to $5.3 billion of capital investment. We're not coasting. We're working diligently to attract more projects every day. And every year, others take note of our successes. We've been named, among other things, one of the 10 best cities to launch a startup, the number one best city to raise a family, the number three best city to start a business, the number three best city for young professionals. Greater Omaha is ready to play a role in the metropolitan revolution, poised to help drive the world's innovation and leading entrepreneurial efforts over the next 50 years. We accomplish more together as our regional economic development partnership has proven. So I hope each of you will be thinking about what you might be able to do to help us be a catalyst in this revolution. We'll be talking impact and action throughout the next hour.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm David Brown, and I'm the President and CEO of the Greater Omaha Chamber. Please enjoy your lunch as we get on with our program. I'm glad that you've each taken some time to spend with us here today. I'd also like to recognize and thank Mayor Gene Stothart for joining us. Gene, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you also to our other elected officials who are here and for your commitment to the vitality of our city and our state. Will Senators Robert Hickeman, Rick Kolosky, Heath Mellow, and Merv Reapy please stand and be recognized? And I offer a special Omaha welcome to our keynote speaker, Bruce Katz. Bruce spent last evening talking to a group, and then again early this morning talking to a group, and I think he still has more to tell us this morning. So thank you very much. We look forward to hearing from you in a couple of minutes. I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Baird Home, D.A. Davison, Deloitte, Lampert Nearson Associates, and Mutual of Omaha Bank. We're grateful for your support of this event and for all that you do for businesses in our community. We'll be hearing from the leaders of these companies shortly as well as they make their film debut. Would representatives from these sponsors please stand so we can recognize your investment in us. Well, if there's a theme to this year, we can definitely say in our community, we don't coast. We accomplish more together. We made great strides with regard to capital investment. Over $600 million in new capital investment was committed to this region this year as a result of our Economic Development Partnership. And with a month to go, the Greater Omaha Economic Development Partnership has already exceeded its 2014 goal and landed 70 projects for Greater Omaha. Over 2,000 new jobs came to us. In addition to that, businesses that already call us home chose to renew their faith in this economy with projects that either retained or added almost 1,200 jobs. 2015 looks just as positive. Over 100 companies are already in our project pipeline that are considering locating and investing in the region in 2015. In addition, our 2014 prospect visits to Chicago, Houston, Atlanta, and several cities in China have set us up for another successful year next year. To further gauge expectations for 2015, we sent this year's Economic Outlook survey to chamber members and business leaders throughout the greater Omaha region. You can find the complete survey results by visiting the site that is indicated on your program, but here are just a few highlights which do indicate great confidence in greater Omaha's economic growth. First, 49% of the survey respondents expect the greater Omaha economy to grow at a faster pace next year than it did this year, while only 6% expect slower growth for Omaha next year. When considering the 2015 outlook for their own businesses, 69% expect sales revenue to increase, 49% anticipate keeping staff numbers level, while 46% indicated they expect to create new positions and hire in 2015. 39% more are planning increased capital investment next year. And more than 50% of business leaders believe that increased demand and a strengthening economy will lead to this better performance in 2015. We know that Greater Omaha is an advantageous place to do business. Business leaders overwhelmingly reiterated that our high quality of life is the biggest reason why. They highlighted our great schools, our reasonable cost of living, and our recreational options as real positive attributes to what would attract people and companies here. They also rated really important the decision as things, to, excuse me, they also rated as most important in the decision to do business here, available labor force, relatively low labor costs, as well as a reasonable tax burden on both businesses and individuals. We might want to take a little question with that one, but that's what they told us. We also wanted to gain insight into what some organizations are facing now and how they plan to address those challenges in the year ahead. So we asked our sponsors what business challenges keep them up at night and how they plan to tackle 2015. Please turn your attention to the screens for the film debut of five of our community leaders.
Well, overall, there are many things that keep me up right now in the business world, one of which that I'm sure all of our business community can relate to is the amount of regulation that we face.
It's becoming more and more complex every day, both within the U.S. and globally, and the costs of compliance are expanding, and the costs of making a mistake with a governmental agency is tremendous.
There's two issues that concern me. First is that we need to be a city where all parts of the city are economically successful. Our success as a business is tied to the quality of life in all parts of Omaha. The second issue is infrastructure. We are a company that's in the infrastructure business, and we are underfunding infrastructure both locally and nationally.
Cybersecurity is a major concern for our industry, mostly because financial services firms hold so much information and money belonging to individuals and institutions.
Fighting cybersecurity today goes far beyond just building a moat around each of our individual businesses. Our customers, vendors, and business partners can unknowingly become hacked, and the attackers will go as far as the bug will travel.
It's a very demanding time economically for our clients and potential clients. They're entitled to and deserve getting value for the dollars they spend. So concentrating on how we can, with our strategic direction, focus on their value and the values that they're looking for, it's important for them and important for us.
The other thing that keeps us awake and that we're grappling with is the changing nature of our workforce. A lot of the younger people that we hire today or the younger people in our organizations, which are the lifeblood of our profession, they have much different views about how they're going to work, where they're going to work, and when they're going to work than a more traditional business lifestyle did back when many years ago when I was starting out. So adapting to that more flexible work experience and more flexible work space has been an ongoing challenge. But one that we have to address and one that all professional services firms, I believe, are going to have to grapple with in the future.
Every business and every network is susceptible to cyber threats. So we will continue to invest in the best technology that we can to ensure that our clients and businesses that we work with are protected. While this can be very expensive, the risk of loss through cybersecurity breaches is far greater.
Well, I hope in 2015 to help educate people and connect those two concerns of economic success throughout all parts of the city with infrastructure investments, and help people understand that by investing in infrastructure, we produce high-quality middle-class jobs.
In 2015, our company plans to make major investments into our IT platform. For a company our size, for example, we would look back a decade, and our IT department is about 10 times larger than it was 10 years ago, and our revenues have tripled.
As to compliance, all you can do is educate like crazy and hire the right kind of people to keep the rest of us informed on the cutting edge of what's happening, because a lot of the rules that we deal with day in and day out, they change. A lot of them haven't even been written yet. So you just have to spend a lot of time and resources and get a lot of very smart people to help us through that. Relative to our talent initiatives, it's really about listening to our people and adopting a whole new state of flexibility that we've maybe never had before.
It's really three things, and I think they're all equally important. The first is it starts with people. It always starts with people. And it's a given that we hire the best and the brightest, but we need to make sure that we're strategically aligning our hires with the needs of our clients. That's number one. Secondly, it's better understanding their businesses. You read it in all the popular literature that one thing that lawyers fall short on is understanding and digging deep on their clients' businesses. And then thirdly is narrowing our scope. We've concluded that to meet the value proposition, that we have to narrow our focus, take what we do best, and build upon that. And I think if we concentrate on those three things, the people, knowing our client's business, and then strategically working with our firm to make sure we have the focus in the what we do best is crucial.
How about a round of applause for our business leaders and their opinions? I'm not giving any away his secrets, but Mike Holm and I were talking earlier, and I'm not sure he would rather have stood up here in front of all of you or stood in front of a camera and done that again. We'll have to figure out which works best for next year. But thank you for being willing to do that. So we've just heard from these business leaders that their big focus for 2015 centers around information technology investments, cybersecurity, and creating workplaces that fit the priorities and values of today's talent. Great thoughts for all of us as we work to anticipate the issues for our own businesses and strive to meet them. A special thank you to KTV for putting together that video for us as we move forward. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Bruce Katz. Bruce is one of the nation's premier economic policy experts. He's charismatic, compelling, and passionate about the economy. He's a vice president at the Brookings Institution, founding director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, and co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution. The premise is that America's largest cities will drive the world's innovation and entrepreneurial efforts over the next 50 years. And that premise is resonating across the country. The founder of the Code for America went so far as to say, quote, "Every citizen needs to understand the metropolitan revolution. If we change cities, we change the country," end quote. With that, Bruce, thank you for being here and for sharing your economic insight with us. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give Bruce Katz a warm Omaha welcome. Thanks, sir.
Chamber for having me here. And also just a shout out to Omaha by Design and to MAPA, your Metropolitan Planning Organization. Because we had a really wonderful session last night at the university around something that I will talk about here, which is the changing spatial geography of innovation and what that might mean for Omaha. So let me start and talk about what I think is a pivotal decade. And I really think you heard some of this from the business leaders in that video. We start really with the fact that we're still recovering remarkably from the Great Recession. We still need to grow 4.9 million jobs to make up the public sector jobs we lost during the recession, but then to keep pace with population dynamics and labor market dynamics. We continue to grow as a country by 25 million people a decade. And so we have a big jobs deficit. As everyone knows, we need better jobs. Because of the recession, because of the collapse of manufacturing in the early part of the last decade, we went from 81 million people living in poverty and near poverty to 107 million in one decade, a quantum leap, because there's essentially wage stagnation in the American economy today. I mean, that's why there's such a push in many parts of the U.S. for minimum wages and living wages. Now, in theory, what you want to do when faced with those kind of supersized economic and social challenges is change your growth model. Pre-recession, we had a model in the United States that was really characterized by consumption and debt. And we're trying slowly to shift to a model where you're getting back to fundamentals. What drives the economy? Having sectors, having companies that are fueled by innovation and driven by exports and global engagement, that's how you create an opportunity-rich economy. You focus on what matters. We have a minor problem because to change a growth model, you might want to have a national government. Our federal government has essentially left the building. Sometimes they literally leave the building for weeks. This is a quote from the former governor of West Virginia. But this is not just about cyclical partisanship. Something structural is happening in the United States. And what's happening is as our country gets older, the share of federal resources that goes to pay for Social Security, for Medicare, for Medicaid, for payment on the debt is going up. And what that's beginning to squeeze out are our investments, not only in defense, but in infrastructure, which was mentioned, in R&D, in education, in housing, and skills. I like to say that our federal government is becoming a health insurance company with an army. And it's basically sending a signal to everyone else in the country, cities, counties, metropolitan areas, and states, by the way, you're in charge. The cavalry is not coming. We can't really get anything done, but this is just the math of a country, like most parts of the world, that is seeing a rapid aging of its society. So that leads to the revolution, because the memo's gone out, and what is remarkable over the past half decade are cities and metropolitan areas, and not just governments. And cities are not governments. The federal government's a government. States are governments. Cities are networks of people like yourselves, corporate leaders, civic leaders, political leaders. And what we're seeing in the United States is they're stepping up and they're doing the hard work of growing their economy. Now, in the U.S., they're doing that because they're so powerful. We have 388 metropolitan areas in the United States, cities and suburbs together. I'm just going to focus on the top 100. The top 100 sit on only 1/8 of our land mass. They're 2/3 of our population, and they're 3/4 of our GDP. And when you look at the stuff that really matters to a national economy, infrastructure, innovation, however you want to measure it, skills, they're at 75, 80, 85, 90% of the national share. We are still the preeminent economy in the world today because we are the quintessential metropolitan nation. And China is rising, and India is rising, and Brazil is rising because they're urbanizing. They're becoming more like us. When you urbanize, what you do is you agglomerate and you concentrate all the assets that matter to an economy. And then you work with your non-metropolitan areas, particularly those in the agriculture sector, so you have a 2+2=5 effect. It's not metros versus non-metros. It's just metros tend to concentrate the power of nations. So our cities and metros are stepping up because they can, because they're the engines of our economy and they're centers of trade and investment. If you want to be a successful, prosperous, inclusive, resilient economy, you make things, you innovate, and that drives consumption. Essentially, that's the message of the recession. So the Metropolitan Revolution, the book, and I'll just say the one pitch, It'll be paperback December 11th, this Thursday on Amazon. And I get no royalties, okay? The book is really about stories. Stories about places like yourself, where in the absence of national leadership, and in some cases, in the absence of state leadership, corporate, civic, political, university leaders coming together to do things. Start with Denver and LA. Denver and LA, and I'll talk more about Denver in a bit, basically are using local resources raised through public referenda to build state-of-the-art transit. Not just to move people around, right? Transit obviously does that, but to send a signal, we're going to have a different development pattern in our city, in our metro, in this century. It'll be more sustainable, it'll be a higher quality of life, and it'll particularly appeal to innovative firms and talented workers that want to be in the cores. Northeast Ohio. This is a story of about a place that was an industrial crisis over many decades, losing manufacturing. This is a story about philanthropy and business coming together to help companies sharpen their business plans, invest in their facilities, retrain their workers, and compete on the global stage. I'll talk more about that. New York, depths of the recession. Bloomberg basically pulls together the top corporate and civic leadership in the city and says, we've got to diversify our economy. We are too dependent on financial services. We don't have enough STEM, science, technology, engineering, math in our system. Let's get a world-beating engineering university into this city, because Columbia and NYU, wonderful places, are not world-class engineering schools. They go out, they compete it. Cornell and Technion are now building a facility on Roosevelt Island, $2 billion of private investment, tens of billions expected over time. Houston. Houston is America on steroids. Fast forward. We will be a majority-minority nation within several decades. Houston is already a majority-minority city. And the transformative investment in that city is a network of community settlement houses that are literally integrating tens of thousands of immigrants every year into the mainstream of the Houston economy. In Houston, the phrase is, we own a future, not a past, right? And they are trying to be at the vanguard of this transformation. Portland, I'll talk about a little more as well. Portland is a very weird and crunchy place. Trust me, I go there a lot. But what it is also is an export powerhouse. They still make things in Portland, and what they particularly make are sustainable products and sustainable services that the rising cities in China and India want. If you Google "We Build Green Cities," what jumps up is not Copenhagen, but Portland. It's a business proposition. Last piece, Detroit, last story. Detroit obviously is a fiscal basket case, right? Just out of bankruptcy. And when you read about Detroit, what you read about is 138 square miles. It's a very large city. Used to be 2 million people. Now it's less than 700,000. But if you go to the core of Detroit, Canada sits to the south, the Detroit River, the downtown, the Woodward Corridor, up to the Midtown, where you have Henry Ford Health, Wayne State, Detroit Medical Campus, College for Creative Studies. The city is coming back. And it's coming back because philanthropy and corporations have unlocked local capital to help renew the city from its core. Again, there was no government. So essentially, this is the broader network of cities basically rallying behind. So let's just talk about Denver for a second, because I think Denver is considered such a success story, we forget that decades ago, this was a place in economic collapse. Remember the oil and gas collapse of the early 1980s. It also was a place where the cities and the counties were at each other's throats. They were fighting over taxes. They were fighting over schools. They were fighting over everything. They came together when the oil and gas collapse happened, and they said, we've got to basically rally together for our region. And they made some bets in arts and culture and the downtown. Bets which are now paying off. What they also did, and this is really important, they laid down their arms. Metro Denver Business Group basically said, you cannot steal from your neighbor, right? You just can't throw some tax incentives to move, you know, a company 2 miles across a border. It makes no sense. It's one region. We're not competing with each other. The Metro Mayors Caucus, the mayors throughout the entire region, decided we will sit together 4 times a year, no press, no media, to talk about the issues that obviously cross borders. So this is a collaborate to compete notion. You fast forward and to Fast Tracks, which is the largest light rail system being built in the United States today with local resources. 0.4% sales tax, about $4.5 billion, 122 miles of light rail. When I visited Denver about 10 years ago and talked to the people planning this, I said, what's your plan? They said, this is a 100-year plan for this region. Because when we've looked at transit in other places like Boston, they started building in the early part of the 20th century, and now they're reaping the benefits of it in the 21st century. That's what we're trying to do. Listen to the Denver leadership talk about collaboration.
The fact that we operate by consensus has meant that sometimes there have been some tough issues that we had to let go. It's more important to these mayors to be in collaboration, to be working together with each other, than it is to be able to attack everything that comes down the road.
It's like a sibling relationship. There are some times when you have tremendous highs and things are running great, and there are other times where you're frustrated and you don't seem to understand where the challenges exist or why they exist at all. But if you care enough, and if it's valuable enough to you, you will work on that relationship and do everything you can to always be prepared to get over those hurdles when they present themselves. There are many cities around the world thinking about how they can out-compete Denver, out-compete Los Angeles, out-compete New York. As a region, if we work together, we can compete against everyone else around the world, and we can do it well. We have a greater chance to be globally connected and globally competitive.
So the word is collaboration. It's an easy word, right? But in a region of your size, again, without the national government paying any attention, essentially, you've got to work together, right? I mean, you've got to come together because you're competing with places abroad today. Last time I was in Denver, I was with the governor of Colorado, who used to be the mayor of Denver, and we were supposed to have dinner together, and I walked into his home, and I said, really looking forward to seeing you. He says, I cannot have dinner today. The mayors are fighting with each other. I'm going to cook dinner for them, and we're going to bring everyone back together. Imagine if that happened in this state. I'm not sure. It would be quite odd. But it just shows you the level of collaboration in that place. Let's go to another part of this country. Let's go to Northeast Ohio. So again, Northeast Ohio, like many parts of the United States, had a brutal manufacturing collapse, right? This was called the quiet crisis. It wasn't like the Pittsburgh steel crisis, where it just sort of happened overnight, right? It happened over several decades, so it was called the quiet crisis. What happened is philanthropy and business came together, and they said, we need to create a series of institutions and intermediaries to help small and medium-sized business. These are not the OEMs, right? This is not Ford Motor. This is not GM. These are the supply chain of the auto industry, of the energy industry. We've got to help these small companies really steel themselves for a new kind of global competition. And also, we've got to bet on the fact that America has to have a manufacturing renaissance. Countries that don't make things don't innovate over time. You just can't have ideas and let the products be produced somewhere else. You have to make things to be innovative. So what they've done in Northeast Ohio is basically provided these small and medium-sized enterprises with the help they need. It could be about access to capital. It could be about strengthening their business plan. It could be around retraining workers. All of that is baked in with these special institutions. In a relatively short period of time, manufacturing is growing again in Northeast Ohio. It's actually growing again in the United States, about 750,000 jobs since the end of the recession. Energy costs are low, right? Manufacturing is incredibly technologically sophisticated. We as a country are technologically sophisticated. But this is a place that came together around it. Listen to this.
it doesn't exist anymore where somebody sits up on the top of the mountain and tells everybody what to do. Any one of us alone is not significant enough to make a difference on a global stage. But when we come together as communities that didn't used to come together and work at this metropolitan level, we can roar with the best of the lions. And I think we're starting to see that, and we're starting to become believers, and we see more and more people joining the revolution.
So this is the Fund for Economic Future, philanthropy and business-backed, working with small manufacturers. When you make things, what do? You sell abroad, increasingly, because the world's urbanizing. Let's go to Portland and just talk about this for a second. When Portland looks out at itself, what does it find? Again, we all know about Portlandia, right? I mean, we all know the jokes about Portland. But this is a very export-intense place, much more export-intense place than most metros in the United States, and looking out to Asia, which is a good place to look to. When you look to Asia, what do you find? You find cities that are growing so fast, they can't literally breathe the air or drink the water. That is not sustainable. It also is a business proposition for any company that wants to work with an Asian city to help them grow in more sustainable ways. Well, that's what Portland
sustainability
does.
Sustainability is, as an emerging industry, the sustainable technology and sustainable services industries is a little abstract for some people, and we saw that as a competitive advantage.
We know how to build cities. We have companies that do the architectural services, the clean technology, the green roofs, all the things that go into making a green city. And don't you want your city to be a little bit like this as well?
What it is that Portland has to offer, and as most of the rest of the world continues to urbanize at a drastically faster pace, we think we have a package of services and goods that are going to be incredibly valuable to those economies all around the world.
So those are three stories, right? But they all come down to the same thing. Collaboration across political, corporate, civic, and university lines. A sense of who they are. A sense of what makes them special in the world. And I think as you're listening to this, it's helpful to have your own thoughts about this place, both the level of collaboration, but also what's your special niche, right? What's your special global position, domestic position, and how do you leverage that? So how do you start a revolution? This is a peaceful one. So first, going back to the point, this is about networks. This is not about the government, right? The mayor and the city council are really important. They're part of the network. But it's not about, well, that's their job. It's everyone's job. So in different parts of the country, networks have been formed in different ways. In New York City, the Bloomberg story, convening people after the crash, it's really a mayor pulling together the corporate and civic leadership. Now, of course, it's Michael Bloomberg. So when he says, come to a meeting, you all show up, right? But still, that's a mayor-led network. When you go to Northeast Ohio, it's philanthropy and business pulling together, creating new institutions, a fund for economic future, intermediaries to help the bio cluster, the energy cluster, right? It's essentially an institutional-led network. And when you go to Detroit, as Paul Simon said, it's a loose affiliation of millionaires and one billionaire, Dan Gilbert, right? It really wasn't anyone taking control or taking charge. It was really different parts of the community coming together around one thing. We have to renew the city from the core of this city. We have to change how we allocate our capital, how we allocate our resources. Now, once you have a vision, or once you have a network, you need a vision. Right? The bottom line is, you know, in the pre-recession economy, when you looked at Denver or Detroit, or you looked at Pittsburgh or Phoenix, it was hard to tell the difference at times because we were so focused on consumption. We were so focused on home building. We were so focused on retail in this country. We forgot to look at the sectors and the clusters and the companies that were actually driving those different places forward. Actually, Denver is a really different place than Detroit. Pittsburgh is a really different place than Phoenix. They have different global assets, different competitive advantages. So what has been happening post-recession are people, metropolitan leaders, have been heeding the advice of Dolly Parton, really that great regional philosopher. Figure out who you are and do it on purpose. Figure out who you are and do it on purpose. When you look at New York, again, that story, depths of the recession, Bloomberg wasn't wringing his hands. He basically said, we have to diversify our economy away from finance. Let's bring in the tech companies. Let's bring in the engineering companies and the universities. And they did that. Northeast Ohio, looking at itself, saying, we still make things, right? And we are not a post-industrial economy. We're an industrial economy. And we want to bet on that again. They did not anticipate shale gas. They did not anticipate rising wages in China. They did not anticipate reshoring. They just bet on manufacturing because they said, that's our DNA. And even Detroit, when they looked at themselves, because every media around the world is basically saying the city's a basket case, why would anyone think about investing in Detroit? They said, actually, in the core of the city, it's only about 7 square miles of the 138 square miles, we still have good assets. We have things that we can invest in and begin to bring back. Last piece, find your game changer. Think about this region in the last 25 years, the last 100 years, the last 150 years. Think about an intervention. It might have been a university. It might have been a rail. It could be anything, right, that changed the trajectory of this place. Usually a public-private kind of investment. That's what's going on in these cities. They're looking at themselves and saying, given our assets, given our challenges, what's the kind of intervention that we can make as a community to get us back on track? Now, in New York, that was, again, an institutional platform for innovation. New York did not have a Carnegie Mellon. They didn't have a Stanford. They didn't have an MIT. They didn't have a Georgia Tech. They went out and got one. Actually, they got two, Cornell and Technion, right? Really interesting. We used to think about universities of like, well, they're anchored. They don't go anywhere. They're anchors. They're weighted down. New York City said, no way. We're going to take some from other places of the world, and we're going to bring them here. In Northeast Ohio, again, it's this sense of don't forget about production. Don't. Because we can be, again, as a country, particularly given NAFTA, particularly given our relationships with Canada and Mexico, we can be a strong production platform for the world. And with 3D printing, and with robotics, and with other technological disruptions, it'll be a different kind of manufacturing than perhaps occurred in the past. But we have to think about that. And finally, Detroit. What Detroit said is today, compared to 15 years ago, the innovative firms and the talented workers don't want to get in their cars uniformly and drive out to a science park, right? Where every company has its own campus, and the theory is keep your secret secret. A lot of companies, not just in the tech sector, but in multiple sectors of this country, want to be in cities and the cores of cities where they can be closer to other workers, where they can have access by transit, where they can be close to essentially the old market portions of the city, right? Renovated warehouses. That's what Detroit's betting on, that the 21st century geography of innovation is not going to look like the late 20th century. And increasingly, I think, not just in Detroit, but in other parts of the country, in other parts of Europe, that is coming to pass. So these are big interventions, locally grown, locally designed, locally implemented. Occasionally the federal government's involved, but they're sort of half-conscious most of the time. So they're not even sure where they're involved. The state comes in and out of the picture. I think what's going to happen in this country in the next 5 years, irrespective of who gets elected president in 2016, is place after place after place, and you're already doing it, are going to stand up and say, we want to be the best 21st century version of ourselves. And we're going to take control of our own destiny. And we're not going to wait for anyone to pass any law or any bill or any program to make that happen. And when that happens, this will happen.
From an early age, we are taught how our nation is supposed to work. The president, vice president, and members of Congress sit at the top. Governors and legislators run their states. The rest of us take our cues from them. While states and the federal government may be part of the Constitution, our population and economic power is actually concentrated in our metropolitan areas. It's time to rethink power in America. In this century, metros will lead and states and the federal government will follow. In cities and metros, public, private, and civic leaders are helping workers get the skills they need, investing in infrastructure and growing jobs through expanded trade and investment, the hard work necessary to renew our economy.
So my last message, I don't get invited to the White House anymore, but which is fine. My last message is this. We are still the preeminent economy in the world and the most advanced society in the world, not because of 537 elected officials sitting in Washington, D.C. We're the most preeminent economy because there are tens of thousands of people like yourself who get up every day and say, I'm going to make this place better, either because I was born here or I came here or I care about it. That's what makes us so powerful and resilient in the United States. We are not waiting for the regs. We are not waiting for Washington. And I think what is happening in this country at this time will be historic. We will look back at this period and say, that's a period of time where cities and metros, not all, but some, stood up and took their future in their own hands. I think Omaha can be that place. You are wealthy, you are smart, you are special. You got great bones going back 150 years. The question is, what will you do with your possibilities? Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce on Noon Forum. We've heard highlights from the 2014 Chamber of Commerce Economic Outlook Luncheon, including the keynote address presented this year by special guest speaker Bruce Katz, Vice President, Brookings Institution, and founding director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. The title of his talk was Insights on the Metropolitan Revolution. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, December 9th, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, Special Events Senior Coordinator at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.